welcome to From the Library with Love, a podcast for anyone whose life has been changed by reading. Hazel Gaynor is an award-winning New York Times, USA Today, Irish Times, and international best-selling author. I, like everybody else, fell in love with Hazel's writing after reading her debut novel, The Girl Who Came Home, a novel of the Titanic. Her ability to evoke a time and a place and fill it with realistic characters is why readers always return to her books. Her new novel, The Last Lifeboat, came out in June 2023 and is due for paperback, I believe, April 2024. And it's another spellbinding and largely untold tale. Welcome, Hazel.
Hello, thank you. What a lovely introduction.
You're welcome. Well, we were talking before we came on about the book, and I read your first book and I've read all your books, but this for me was just outstanding. Let's just start by telling us about the premise for The Last Lifeboat, so anybody listening gets an understanding of what it's about.
Yeah, thank you. What a lovely endorsement. Yeah, this is my 10th novel. So there's been a lot in between, but it seems like from The Girl Who Came Home, set on the Titanic, and now coming to The Last Lifeboat, another tragedy at sea, it seems I'm pulled to... something about stories of survival, stories of loss and hope and human endurance. And The Last Lifeboat is inspired by this astonishing true event, which I hadn't heard of before I found this, which took place in the middle of World War II, when children were evacuated overseas. So I think we're all familiar with Operation Pied Piper and children being evacuated from the cities to the countryside at the start of World War II. But this was in 1940, when it was believed the Nazis and Hitler were going to invade Britain, and therefore coastal countries, places were no more safe. The children were sent overseas, and just a sort of unimaginable scenario to find yourself in as a parent. You know, you're not safe at home, but then this perilous journey, going to live with strangers for how long, nobody knew. What an unimaginable, agonizing choice. And not only that, but one of the ships that was taking children from Liverpool to Canada was actually torpedoed by a U-boat in the middle of the Atlantic. And that is the premise upon which The Last Lifeboat is built, and this remarkable story of a missing lifeboat full of survivors lost at sea. And that was really, again, you know, fact is stranger than fiction. And I just couldn't believe that this had happened. So what an amazing sort of moment of inspiration to write a novel around.
Yeah, don't you love that light bulb moment when you discover something and you think, God, I never knew that. And there's almost like two threads in a way that run through the book, because obviously there's the sort of the jeopardy that builds in the book, because as readers we know where the story ends up, but sharing that mother's moral quagmire over whether to send your children away, and it's almost intensified, because it's not like just putting them on a train at King's Cross to send them to Cornwall. You're putting them on a ship to send them to another country. I mean, my God, I was all the way through, that was sort of underpinned when I was reading it, thinking, what would I have done? And I know this is a really awful question to ask, but what would you think you would have done in Lily Nicole's shoes? Would you, as a mother, do you think you could have? I know there's no easy answer to that, but what do you think you would have done?
It's the impossible choice, isn't it? And it's that was actually what I kept coming back to when I was writing The Last Lifeboat, is it's the consequence of choice. So it was, you know, this awful situation where the Blitz bombing raids had just started, and therefore you're not safe in central London, where my character, my entirely fictional character, by the way, Lily Nicholls, is really a composite of, you know, lots of ordinary women who were keeping things going at home and haven't been really given a voice much in fiction or in history at that point. So Lily is really a composite of that ordinary woman, you, me, anybody that this could happen to. And, you know, here she is facing this awful decision as to whether to, instinctively, I think you would want to keep, as a mother, you'd want to keep your children with you. They're always going to be safer with you. And yet, the threat of bombs, the threat of invasion, and there's an opportunity here. The government funded, you know, the cost of taking the children away, because lots of families in the most dangerous parts of the UK couldn't afford to send their children away, whereas more wealthy families had done so privately. Again, the privilege of wealth.
Yes.
And Lily's decision is ultimately that her children will be safer sent overseas. You know, we often think, I think when we look back on events like the World Wars, that somehow the women, men, children at that time were better placed to deal with this, that they were somehow more resilient or more prepared. Of course they weren't. You know, this
No,
was
you're right.
no more acceptable to them than it would be if somebody knocked on mine or your door tomorrow and said, okay, quick choice. Are your children staying with you? Or are you going to send them away where they'll be safer technically? I mean, just, horrifying. And I suppose I wrote Lily's decision in ultimately what I possibly would have done. There is an incident very close to home that ultimately makes Lily make the choice she does. And from a narrative arc in the story, of course, I needed to have her make a decision to put her children on my fictional ship, the Belle Isle, but it's based on a real ship called the City of Benares. And it is that, the agony and the consequence of choice that spreads through the
And I
book
love
into
that
two
because
women.
it makes it so relatable for anybody reading it. You know, my God, these were just ordinary women in an extraordinary circumstances having to make life-changing choices on the spot. And of course, you'd never know that, you know, had she not sent them there and then they'd stayed here and then got killed in a Blitz bombing raid, or had she kept with her, you never know. And I suppose that was the situation, but magnified for millions of women in Britain living with the
Absolutely.
consequences of choice.
And that's it, and there are, you've used an example there of stories where the decision was taken to keep children, even just on a daily basis, to not go into the bomb shelter because some of the brick surface shelters were not made very sturdily, shall we say. And the part of Lily's story is she's afraid of the bomb shelter. And some families didn't go to the bomb shelter, stayed in their own
No.
home. That was directly hit, obliterated. And then you have these fears everywhere. This fear is like a bear in all directions. Where do you run to? What do you do? And the sort of futility of war, I think that's what kept coming back to me, that there isn't any safe place. There isn't any good
No,
outcome.
you're so right. I'm really nodding my head furiously because you're so right. There was no safe place. You know, like you said, you put them in a brick street surface shelter, well, the ceiling collapses. You send them down to the underground where allegedly it was safer, and then you look at what happened at Bethnal Green, where 173 people were, many children, trampled to death on the steps down. There was,
Horrendous.
in reality, there was no safe place in wartime. Even, I mean, I suppose it was generally safe around the countryside, but that came with its own sort of moral choices as well, sending your children to live with strangers. So I love the way that you really get under the skin of that and tease all those out. So you yourself are in those characters' shoes and straight away empathizing. And then you get onto the secondary strand where obviously the boat is torpedoed and the last survivors end up lost drifting in the Atlantic in this boat. And it was so, and then it takes on almost the tone of a sort of a thriller, if you like, because you can think who's going to be left standing at the end of this. And I, those scenes where I was reading it, I was so vividly imagined that honestly, I felt my mouth grow dry and I felt quite parched, and I got that horrifying sense of reality just drifting away. How did you research that so convincing and write it so convincingly? Because that's not an easy thing to put yourself into the shoes of.
No, and fortunately have never been in that experience, but you'd probably be surprised to hear, or maybe not, but I'm actually terrified of the ocean.
And yet you're drawn to it and you write about it.
keep writing about it.
Maybe
That's
exploring
probably
your
why.
fears, perhaps.
I'm not a strong swimmer. I get horribly seasick. The ocean terrifies me. So there probably is, a very
How
instinctual
funny.
sense in me of just being on water, and that, the horror, the depth of water, I find terrifying. And that, obviously at the time, this lurking threat of U-boats. So not just being on water, but what's actually happening under the water. And there's something incredibly sinister, I think, about the U-boats. And as Alice says in the book, and Lily, with the air raids, there's a warning. There's a sound, you can hear a plane approaching. With a U-boat, you can't. And it is this terror that Lily kind of carries with her. And Alice, who is a volunteer, so the government program, the Children's Overseas Reception Board, asked for men and women to volunteer to escort these evacuees, the sea evacuees, as they were called, on these ships. And my character, Alice, is very much based on a real volunteer, Mary Cornish, who went on City of Benares, the torpedoed ship, and found herself the only woman in the lifeboat of survivors, and very much tasked with the welfare of the children in that lifeboat, keeping them distracted, entertained, warm. And Alice is my sort of imagined version of her. So I read a lot of survivor accounts of life day-to-day life in that lifeboat, the very, very minuscule becomes enormous, you know. So just how are we going to drink? How do we go to the toilet? That person's leg is really digging into my back, you know, all those sort of the irritations, I think, of close proximity to people and how things become massive. So this little sort of microcosm of life in this lifeboat drifting across a stormy Atlantic, you know, conditions at sea were shocking. So nothing could have been, you know, it was as bad as it could possibly have been. So it was really, I suppose, a combination of reading survivor accounts of both this event and wider. You know, I'm fascinated by survival. I often watch documentaries of survival and hardship and what does the human spirit do in that situation? And then obviously imagining, so you let your imagination imagine the worst. And what would you think? What would you feel? What would you do? Would you help? Would you withdraw? What role would you play in that little society that's created in a lifeboat?
It's so fascinating. Just listening to you talk about that, two things that strike me. One is that I wonder, as writers, we are drawn instinctively to things that we need to process in our own brain, because you being terrified of water, and yet you've written about the Titanic and now this and stories of survival. I feel the same about being underground or in very claustrophobic small spaces. And yet I seem to continuously go underground in my stories and put myself in those situations. And it's only now as you're talking, I'm thinking, yeah, I wonder, I'm sure a psychologist would have a field day with that. But
absolutely.
Why we process and face the unimaginable through the safe lens of fiction. I don't know, but it's an interesting listening to you. To you talk.
And you know, you said that those scenes in the lifeboat, they almost feel like you're now reading a thriller, and you know, I think that wasn't in any way done as a, oh, I'm now writing this as a thriller. I guess it was just the intensity of and the pacing of the book in those chapters.
I loved the change of pace, because it suddenly felt, oh, here we go, we're getting a new fresh tone here.
Yeah, and it's the relentlessness. So it was almost the challenge of creating intensity in a situation that is incredibly dramatic, and who gets out of here. So obviously that's the page turning aspect. There's a ticking clock here, but also nothing changes. So you're in a lifeboat, you're still in a lifeboat, you're still with the same people, you're still in the sea, there's nothing to look at, you're not going anywhere. So it was that kind of tension of building conflict and drama where your location is exactly the same.
That's a challenge. That's a real challenge to a writer, actually, isn't it? Because you can't, you know, the sky is the same blue, so is the water, the people are the same. So you've almost stress tested yourself a bit there as a writer, haven't you, by keeping that same setting. And I love as well the way you're talking about survival. I'm fascinated by that as well. I've been watching recently this program called Alone, where they send people off to the Arctic, and they have to, and basically the winner is like the last person standing. And I don't know why, but I'm just fascinated by these people thrown out into the Arctic wastelands of Alaska, and they have to build their own huts and kill squirrels and fish to survive. And I just think, I don't think I would last 2 minutes in those scenarios. But yeah, I'm fascinated by it.
I'm the same, you know, and it's like, you know, anything sort of human peril, you know, where people take on these enormous tasks of like climbing, you know, the Dawn Wall, things like that in Yosemite, and sort of free climbing, free diving. There's a documentary called Deep Breath about free divers. And it, again, the sort of terror of water and not even having breathing apparatus. And I think there is something in us as human beings that's fascinated by that sort of sense of drama and peril, and wondering what we would do. It's sort of almost imagining the worst and thinking, well, it will never happen to me.
Maybe it's strangely life-affirming as well. Like, we just got back from Yosemite, and hearing you talk about that, and we were staring up at the wall of El Capitan, and people were climbing up it, and you just think, why do they do it? Why do you put yourself in these situations? I guess it's to feel alive at a kind of really cellular level. I don't know, but I find the whole thing fascinating. So from that perspective, I just, that's why I enjoyed your book on so many levels.
And, you know, that's amazing as well, because that actually comes out. I mean, Alice does say when she's in probably the worst point of being in the lifeboat. And of course, with hindsight, we know how long the war lasted. We know the key events. At the time, it was endless. It was a bit like us going through COVID. Nobody knew when this was going to end. Nobody knew the outcome, the resolution. How were things going to get back to normal? So it's that sort of the sense of helplessness, because you don't know if rescue's coming. And Alice has this moment of feeling so helpless and lost, and yet there's this visceral need to live. And at that point, you know, she thinks about what she has to yet accomplish in life or what she has done. And it is that, I suppose, the play, and that's what I love reading in fiction, is that, and in nonfiction actually, the play of hopelessness and hope, you know, that comes out of those worst situations. I mean, we see the best and the worst of people, don't we, when things are at the most challenging. And that's ultimately what I hope comes out of The Last Lifeboat, is there is this arc of hope and endurance and the goodness of people.
And the redemption and that, I mean, without putting loads of spoilers in it for people that haven't read it, but the end scenes are so life-affirming. And, I, you know, I've got such a lump in my throat by the end of it, just because you know it's sort of coming, but it does take you on that roller coaster of emotions, taking that wide sweep of survival and who will emerge, etc. But the other thing I loved about it is the writing, of course, because it's great that you've got the change of pace and researching and this sort of scenes of survival, but the writing itself is so beautiful. I love this opening scene, which I'll read if I may. If that's all right, Hazel, or you could read it. Like,
thank you.
Just that point where you said, Alice can't breathe. The wind snatches her breath away, leaving her gasping for air. She half jumps, half stumbles and falls face down against the boards. She tries to pull herself up, but the lifeboat pitches violently and another monstrous wave smashes into them and throws Alice into the woman beside her. The woman loses her grip on the rain-slicked mast and tumbles with extraordinary grace into the dark ocean, her white nightdress furling around her as she spins and turns like a ballerina in a pirouette. And I love that. I love that so much, because I love writing that almost paints with words. And I could so easily visualize it, this white nightdress billowing down and then sliding into the dark waters and then gone. For me, that's a scene, you know, that I'm hooked straight in with that opening scene. So do you sort of consciously write like that? Have you always written like that?
Yes, is the answer. I came to writing very organically. You know, I have never done a writing course, you know, a sort of technical writing craft course. I just write as I feel. And I have always written that way. And it's come through, you know, from readers and reviewers over the years, this sort of almost cinematic.
Yeah, that was the word I was thinking of as I was reading it, cinematic quality.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I suppose I see what I'm writing. And I don't know if this is the same for everybody. I kind of assume it is, but maybe not, that I see on the page very, very clearly, very visually. You know, clearly I'm just waiting for the movie adaptation.
It's coming. It'll come.
But I do. And I see my scenes in my head as if I'm watching the movie of what I'm writing. And I love, we were talking a little bit off air about, you know, the job of writing. And sometimes it's being very front facing and promoting the book. And sometimes it's incredibly private and personal. And I really love when I'm in the zone and I'm writing away and I have a cold cup of coffee on my desk.
Yeah, time slips away.
Time slips away.
And kids don't get fed. Yeah,
exactly.
I know what you mean. That, and you know, you've slipped into that wonderful almost half world where you look out and you think, oh, the sky's changed colour, and you haven't noticed because you're not there. You're in a lifeboat in, you know, 1940 or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of building the, I mean, there's layers to writing, isn't there? And we, you know, we all write a kind of pretty rough first draft, or maybe that's just me.
Everybody.
And we layer and we find the right shape for the story, the right pacing. There's a lot of kind of technical stuff in there. And it's then that like lovely, just really going for it with your prose. And I do really love, and sometimes I have to dial back because I think I would just write beautiful prose until the cows come home, but there'd be no plot. Something has to happen.
Yeah, because you're so in it.
Yeah. It's pretty.
Well, no, but you could write like that. You could, and we'd still read it, but yeah, I guess it does need a beginning, middle and end.
Yeah.
And I, one other thing I love is kind of surprises in history. And I feel that you instinctively understand that, you know, teasing out and exploring the lesser known elements of 20th century history, like the anger of the bombing of the sea evacuees, which is a great word. I'd never even heard of that until I read your book, sea evacuee, or the Japanese army's internment of teachers and children in World War II. Do you consciously seek out the sort of forgotten or untold stories, or is it just because that's what interests you?
A little bit of both. So over the years, I've become, I suppose, more specific about what I want to write. I mean, the Girl Who Came Home, my first novel, very instinctive, always been fascinated by Titanic.
Mm.
That was actually the second full book I ever wrote. The first one's hidden away, never to be seen, as we all have. But and I think from there, I have gone back to things that have stayed with me from being quite young. So I've written about Grace Darling, again, disaster at sea, lighthouse keeper up in the Farne Islands in Northumberland. I've written about the Cottingley Fairies, a little kind of folklore story from Yorkshire where I grew up. So I have dipped back into things that have fascinated me all my life. But then things like Last Lifeboat and previous to that, The Bird in the Bamboo Cage, The Internment of British Children and Teachers in China, they were stories that I heard for the first time at the point at which I was thinking about ideas for my next book. So I suppose they were more clinically found, if that's the right word. Sort of, I'll spend a bit of time loosely reading around things, or I might hear something or see something when I'm wasting time on social media. You know, and I think you sort of become a bit of a historical magpie, don't you?
Oh, you do,
find
yeah.
Something and
swooping
think,
around, looking for that little flashing gold.
Yeah, and you know, I think everybody who's writing historical fiction is just so amazing. You know, all the books that are out there, and each one is pretty much, I'd never heard about that. I didn't know about that. So, you know, just like you've done with your stories, and so many historical novelists have, there are these gems and these remarkable stories waiting. I think that's why we're drawn to historical fiction.
Yeah, it must be, mustn't it?
Back out, you know, and something that people in the wider sphere, you know, maybe haven't heard of, as I hadn't heard of the sea evacuees, and, you know, similarly haven't heard of these underground wartime libraries that you've written about so beautifully. So there's a pull, isn't there, to sort of excavate that history and put shape and colour. I always think about adding colour to something that's black and white with thoughts and feeling and emotion, and make it accessible. It's history, but it's tangible history.
Yeah, but it's still a story, isn't it? Because I think you and I could both write the stories that we've written in a non-fiction way. But yeah. I had a wonderful quote. I think it was Barnes & Noble that's, you know, saying that writing non-fiction allows us to learn about the past. Reading fiction, historical fiction, allows us to be moved by the past.
Yes.
So I've always had this push-pull, being a journalist by background, do I write a good non-fiction book about this issue? But now I've come to realise, really, I suppose just through talking to readers and understanding and reading a lot in this genre myself, you can still be true to the facts of the story, but actually by presenting it with a character and all that colour and feeling your way into it and getting swept away in this story, is that you are actually learning way more about the past that way, because you care and you're moved and you feel something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, readers who come to, and if you hear this as well, I often hear from readers and they'll say, you know, they didn't enjoy history at school. It was quite sort of boring and academic and sort of trudging through historical notes of dates and battles.
Wading through medieval kings and queens. I was exactly the same.
Yeah. And I think, interestingly, with war in fiction as well, I mean, I famously once said to my cat husband, whoever was listening at the time, I could never write a novel about the war, because I thought war was a very male thing, sort of bloody battles and sort of military men pushing things around on maps to sort of strategically plan where there are armies
and bunkers and dad's army and all that.
Absolutely. And yet then I think when you discover these stories, which obviously for me, I'm very interested in the ordinary woman, the ordinary person like me, who was involved in that. And I have fascinating family history. You know, my great-grandmother lost her son, went missing in action in World War II, as it turned out, in Africa. So there's tangible family connection that I think we probably all have in some way back to the war. It's not that long ago. And that made it feel very accessible and relatable. It's almost like this evergreen event that keeps touching people's lives, and new stories keep being found and people want to talk about it. But I think if I wrote it as a non-fiction, I wouldn't feel that emotional connection. And I think that's what brings me to a historical piece.
Yeah,
isn't the facts, it's the emotion.
I totally agree. And I think we all want sort of escapism as well, don't we? We want to be pulled into the past and made to feel something. And that kind of leads into the next question, which is, why do you think that we, particularly women, have this voracious appetite for historical fiction, particularly World War II? And I guess probably because it is recent history, we're all affected and moved by it. But what does it fulfill in us, do you think? And I asked this as well, because I spent the weekend at Chatham Dockyards. I was selling books on a stand at the Salute to the 1940s festival. And it was such an eye-opener. There were all these recreation guys in tin hats and Dad's Army, but there was a huge swathe of young women in their 20s dressing up in these outfits. And they would come up and they would say, I love history. I'm like a sponge. I just absorb it. And they're obviously getting immersed and swept away and engaged by stories from the past. So it's just got me thinking, and talking to you as well now, is why, what is it that it fulfills in us? Or if not even fulfill, it just opens a door for many of us.
Yeah, do you know, it's a fascinating question. And I've thought about this a lot. And, you know, that's amazing to hear that there are, you know, the younger generation.
Right, I was like, great, next generation of readers.
Now you just need to get it on TikTok.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I think, oh, I don't know.
You know what I think it is, partly? I think there's an elegance about the past. And even with periods of war, and I think, you know, on one level, maybe it's fashion, maybe it's etiquette, maybe it's social, you know, sort of construction around people's lives. And I think there was clearer lines in the past. You know, you could do certain things. There was everything's so blurred now. Everything's so fast-paced and relentless. I keep coming back to that. There's this sort of elegance in how people went about their lives, as I say, from even how they dressed, how people communicated, how people corresponded, how people met. And I think maybe in this crazy time that we're living in, there's this longing for something a little simpler and a little bit more ordered. Now, there were other, you know, sort of inhibitions that went with that. And, you know, women's lives were incredibly challenging in different periods of history. But that's what I keep going back to.
I think you're right. I definitely think you're right. We live in such an angry, polarized world.
We do. Yeah.
And maybe there is a danger of sugarcoating the past, but at the same time, life was undoubtedly simpler and women knew where they were and who they were and where they stood. And there was all those social concepts. But of course, then, you know, I suppose the turmoil of war threw all that up in the air and this intriguing concept of women stepping out of the home and taking on these new jobs and roles. But still, I think there is, that word elegance is really, really good. I know what you mean. I was watching these young women walking around in these beautiful tea dresses and straw hats and baskets and little tea bar sandals, and elegant on a kind of sartorial level, but also elegant in the way that they held themselves and the way they composed themselves. And I think also that sense of community as well was so strong, that everybody, you know, you knew the people down your street, that, you know, people lived. I got the sense, and I hope this isn't sugarcoating it too much, that people did live collectively, not individually. There was that duty of care to other people.
And you're absolutely right that, you know, there is that temptation to, you know, rose-tinted, I think the overdone sort of blitz spirit situation, that's the sort of narrative that's been forced upon those events. And yet when you go back and you read how people did look out for each other, I think that's what I mean as an elegance. It's almost like an etiquette thing, the style of things. And that's nice to sort of do, dress up in those lovely, beautiful clothes. It was a simplicity, not to sort of dumb down the life that people led them. But there is that sense of everyone's very disparate now. We're all sort of fighting our own battles. And there was a much clearer sense of, you know, sort of community care, looking out for each other. And we just don't physically, we don't have that because of how we all live our lives and we commute and everyone's, you know, hectically busy all the time and very polarized. So, and I think, you know, also there's a distraction, isn't there, in historical fiction? I think when things are crazy now, there is something nice, comforting about going back in time to not read about more of how awful life is now, but to read about a different time and place. I think there's something about that as well in historical.
I agree. And it's interesting because I think And when I was researching the Little Wartime Library and seeing what people were reading in during the Second World War, and historical fiction was massive. So people were reading about the Great Fire of London. They were reading about the Spanish Armada. And I got the sense that they were looking to the ways that England had been under fire and at threat of invasion and had rebuilt itself from great fires for a sense of continuity. And so too, this shall pass. We look to the past for reassurance. So maybe that's what we in the 21st century are doing now as young women. We're looking to the Second World War for guidance about how people survived. You're right. There's a whole murky sort of other side to it with, you know, propaganda and how we've been painted with this Blitz spirit. There was a lot of anger and exhaustion as well. But despite that, there was that spirit of unity, perhaps. So maybe that's what we're subconsciously looking for when I looked at these women walking around, buying historical fiction, immersing themselves in that world. That's what perhaps we're looking for. But it's great for us as authors, isn't it, that absolutely they do.
No, and I think, you know, it's really encouraging to hear that. And I think as a writer of historical fiction, I mean, you do feel responsible for, I suppose, portraying a period of time authentically and also wanting to create an engaging read that's going to appeal to the modern reader who's very distracted by their phone and Spotify and whatever else we're competing with. And there is that balance in how you dip into the past and making it an enjoyable, it doesn't have to always have a happy ending, but a fulfilling reading experience. And you know, I think historical fiction, maybe more than other genres, can span all age groups. I mean, I've had readers, you know, teenage readers all the way through the full lifespan. You know, people find something to connect and relate to
their experience.
Yeah.
So how do you walk that line between truth and fiction? Like, how much of the real story do you weave in? How do you decide what to leave out? What made you think, okay, I'm going to change that to a different name? Every writer has such an individual, different approach to it. Do you just do it organically, instinctively?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain decisions. Like at the very beginning, when I understood enough about the events surrounding this torpedo ship, the City of Benares, and I felt confident to create a novel around that, you know, and lots of ideas don't have the legs to create a full story out of it. And then I very quickly knew I was going to tell this from two women's points of view, a woman based on Mary Cornish, who was going to be in the lifeboat, and a woman back in London who had made the decision to send her children. And they have only met once very briefly. And it's how this sort of legacy of fate connects people, which I'm also fascinated by. And then, you know, I decided it wasn't going to be the factual account of the City of Benares. So I changed the name of the ship. I put fictional characters into that lifeboat. Again, some of them are composite of the survivors and the stories of people I had read. And I think that's a conscious decision you have to make quite early on. You know, how much are you putting real people in here? And if so, how far do you want to go with that? For me, there's always a sort of a release of creating a fictional character because I'm not inhibited then by what actually was their life story. I can add problems, motivations, relationships into their life that can create narrative tension on the page, but is still true to the period, the event that's happened.
Yeah.
There's always things that have to go. You know, we all have those cut scenes. I never delete anything. I have massive...
No. It's all grist to the mill, isn't it? Cut, paste, leave it for something else.
I might use it one day and by the time the book is written, you're like, oh my goodness, what was I even thinking about that? So I think you just have to be sort of quite ruthless at times, you know, and be honest to the story. And I think, you know, I'm very much a pantser. I don't plot.
Oh wow, that was a question I was going to ask next.
Which is quite terrifying sometimes. I have, I suppose, driven by the history. So for example, with this event, there were certain key moments that I knew I was going to drive towards, but how you get there and who's at play and what happens in the end was sort of up to me. So that sort of comes as I'm writing, and I find and feel my way into a story. And I think by the end, it's what serves the story, what's true and what feels honest. And you can tell as a writer and a reader when something feels shoveled in just because you felt it was interesting at the time or this fascinating thing you found. So I think you have to be really brave, don't you, as a writer, and you have to be prepared to leave things out to better serve what's left in.
Yeah, you have to step out of your own ego to some degree, don't you, and sit back and go, well, what is this, just me because I've spent 5 hours at this archive and I really like it, so I'm gonna layer it all in? Or are you going to serve the, yeah, you're right, the reader is king and queen, and as is the story, so if it's not serving it, it must go. But that's quite brutal. It's quite a hard thing to learn. I think you're always learning that, aren't you, with each new book?
Yeah, and you know, thank goodness for author notes, because that's where we get to put it all back in.
Exactly, that's the best bit. That's the bit I love. My editor said, my US editor, she said, I've never seen a book where there's almost as much at the author notes as the actual story.
But you know, it's about, you know, when you find, don't you find so many things, and you know, and you can spend days and hours down a rabbit hole, and there's one little thing in there, or there's loads of stuff but you can't put it in. And you know, I sometimes use little devices. So in The Last Lifeboat, I've used fictional versions of the archive, the mass observation archive. It was another fantastic, fascinating.
I love the mass observation archive. That's a book in that, isn't there?
Well, there is. I mean, Becky Brown, so Blitz Spirit, she has compiled the archive of mass observation, where there was like 500 people, all walks of life in Britain, asked to basically, you know, create a social diary of what their observation
of, like, an anthology of ourselves,
it's,
wasn't it?
Fabulous. Yeah, and that's where you get that, you know, the really honest. People were certainly not being all sort of comrades and, you know, communities. Miserable and complaining and sort of poor me. It's absolutely brilliant. And
I just love the way you put that just reminded me that at the start of each chapter you have a little extract from the MO diaries. That was so intriguing. That was so well done. That was cherry on the cake for me.
Yeah, and that again, it was just another layer of, I was fascinated by it. And I read a lot of those actual accounts from mass observation, and then I created my own fictional version of diarists, and obviously then as you read it, the reason for them hopefully becomes clear. But so again, sometimes you just have to find a device in the book to bring in something that's a nice change of pace for the reader, or a little mystery that threads through, but it doesn't always work. So
device, that though. I love chapter headings, because you can really use them to serve and to strengthen the story, which that really did, because you're telling another story about World War II, and that it wasn't all, you know, gung-ho spirit and everybody, you know, linking arms and clapping each other on the back, that there was a lot of darkness and despair and exhaustion. And that was a really clever device of telling that through the mass observation diaries. But they are great, those, aren't they? Because they're such a way of hearing the voices and innermost thoughts and feelings of women whose opinions would be lost to history without that. Yeah, we would never hear those. It would always be histories of upper middle class white men.
Exactly. You know, and the sort of day-to-day problems, it's, you know, an ordinary woman thinking, what are we going to have for dinner? Which is a very different story of war to, as I said, you know, the military men pushing those little models of chips around on their maps. You know, I'm just thinking of Churchill here, but you know, it's a totally different, and I think that's why a lot of women say, oh, I'm not interested in war. Well, maybe not interested in the war you've been presented with to date, but when you connect with somebody on a sort of visceral life experience level, it opens it all up.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's why the books that you write and so many other brilliant historical fiction authors write is a way of opening up an unseen facet of Second World War that we've never discovered before, and a way of amplifying those voices and celebrating those contributions that women made to, you know, to the social, the historical, the economic and political to some degree, but mainly domesticated life. So I was going to ask about whether you plot in advance, but you've just told me you don't, so I think that's amazing. How do you like to write? Do you have a routine?
Well, I want to say yes, but does any writer have a routine? I'm not sure. What I will say is I have always approached writing as I approached my previous, you know, jobs. So I'm very much a 9-to-5, if you know, sort of based around the kids' school schedule, really. So, you know, writing is a second career for me. I was in totally different jobs, very corporate, professional, suited and booted in big sort of, you know, London accountancy firms, law firms. So this is something I came to later in life. Has been a, you know, a revelation for me in terms of my creative outlet. And I should have been doing this the whole time, but anyway, we got there eventually. So I've come to writing from a really different mentality. So it is my job. And I think unfairly, particularly women, are often sort of, it's assumed it's a hobby. It's assumed it's a nice little thing that we do. And I know we all get that at some point. And I've always taken this very seriously, and I'm careful about how I talk about writing as a career, because it can often be sort of infantilized a little bit, when particularly I think for women. So I do have a routine of sorts, which is flexed around, we were just saying, you know, we're just coming out of the school summer holidays, which in Ireland is 12 weeks, by the way.
Oh my God, is it?
I know. Yes. Yeah, I know. Look, I know the horror.
It looks like an hour. That's a quarter of the year. God.
Yeah, I find a way, and I, you know, it's a routine of whether today's a writing day or a researching day or a publicity day, but every day is a working day. There's loads of lovely sound bites and quotes, isn't there, about sort of writing 365 days of the year. Well, I can't do that, you know, because Christmas is precious.
Yeah. I don't think you have to be, you know, locked away in a garret writing every single day of the year.
No, and it can be anywhere. You know, I think, thank goodness for laptops and a notebook. I was getting two tyres replaced on my car yesterday. I took the laptop to the garage, you know, and sat there and typed away for an hour and a half. I think it's about discipline as much as routine, I think. And it's whatever that writing day looks like. And that changes as you get into different stages of copy editing, means, like, for me, more desk-based focus and tearing your hair out. And then, you know, sort of publicity is obviously suitcase and off we go. So it has to change for the cycle of publishing, but I do try and have discipline, if not routine. Yeah. And I'm not one for candles and everything. I mean, if you could see my desk now, you'd send in somebody to help me, because it's quite shocking.
I really like that dispelling the candle myth, though, because I think you're so right that it can be dismissed as a sort of women's creative, oh, she's off doing her little bit of writing. And actually, the majority of writers I know are ruthlessly disciplined and about their time, and they safeguard their time, and they're so organized. And there are so many different facets to it. Like you say, like whether you're researching, whether you're in the zone writing, or you're copy editing, or you're structural edits, or whether you're out on the promotion and publicity, there's so many different facets, and you have to treat each one with the same degree of attention and that ruthless work ethic. And those are the people that succeed, I suppose, aren't they?
That's it. And it's about, you know, so sometimes, we were talking earlier about being published in the States as well, and obviously they're on a totally different time schedule, so often I can start work again in the evening, because then that's when emails start to come in from the States. And we were saying, sometimes you can do an event at midnight because you're connecting with
the States. Yeah, you're sitting there in your pajamas, bottom down, and then you've got lipstick and a nice blouse on, and you're talking to somebody in Minnesota. But I mean, can't moan about it. You've got to do it. Can't.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, every writer I have ever met is so passionate about what they do. And it's therefore, it's ruthless hard work, but it's because we're driven to create the best work we can, to connect with readers, to get the next idea off and running. And that big, 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 big breakout moment we're all searching for. You know, so it's joyful hard work, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a sort of gold covered treadmill. I don't know. I feel like we're always on the treadmill. You were always striving for the next, searching for the next. And it is a joy to do it, and it's a privilege, but it is, I do think people need to understand the level of work that goes and structure.
You know, I have a really dear friend, and she talks about her dream job, and I get cross and I say, it's not a dream job, don't say it's a dream job. It makes it sound like fluff. And, you know, it's an incredibly, like you say, it's a wonderful job to do, but you've got to commit. You can't sort of just go, I'll write tomorrow when I feel like it, when the muse strikes. I mean, what, I don't understand that.
No.
I write every day.
I agree. And most days when you're writing, I always feel like it's like when you, especially when you first start writing a book, I always feel like it's when you go to a party and you don't know anyone and you're making small talk. That's how I feel with my characters. I don't know them. I'm just sort of, it's slightly awkward and clunky, but then there's no other way to get to know them than showing up each day and painting your bum with glue. Does anybody eat Volivants now? But no, you're right. You're right. That's the way to do it and to get to know them. And it's not a dream, because a dream's not a reality, is it?
Absolutely.
We're jobbing writers. But every so often there is that magic, isn't there? You know, perhaps when you, that moment where you suddenly realize, you know, this character inside out, and you've just written for 3 hours without realizing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that those are magic moments, you know, when there's a lot of words on the page where you're really sort of grafting to get them out, and it feels like walking through sand and treacle at the same time. And yet you have to get through that to get to the, you know, the lovely, you know, lapping waters of the shore. And it's that sort of, it's the determination, isn't it? It's grit and determination to just push on and find the loveliness within the muddle of stuff that you have to get out to get to the. And I think that's what I didn't understand when I started writing. I thought my first draft was the draft. You know, now when I talk to writers who are on that journey, and it's like, just give yourself permission to be not great. It's fine. That's normal. Yeah. Don't seek perfection. If you seek perfection, you'll give up. You'll never create. And that's the thing in your head, you'll never be on the page. You'll get close, but I don't know if we ever fully create what we had in our head when we started. And it's making peace with that. That's my advice.
Agreed.
Keep writing.
Absolutely agree. That first draft is just that. I always feel a relief though when that first draft is down, because then at least you can begin to shape and you come to it with a different mindset. I kind of enjoy it. But you're right, it's so much tenacity and involved in it. I love climbing mountains. That's what I really love doing. And I often think it's a little bit like writing a book, because there's a lot of sweat and pain and relentlessness. And then at some point you surface onto the summit and you look out at the view and it's gorgeous. And I get an enormous sense of satisfaction from that, as I do. Not that I ever read the book when it comes out, but when it finally is as polished as it's ever going to be. So maybe there's something about that slog, that process.
That's a brilliant analogy, you know, and it's about, the goal is the summit, isn't it? And that is that's the idea that you have that creates the magic and the muddle on the page on the way. And I think it's that there's a real sense of achievement and accomplishment when it doesn't always happen when I sort of type the end, because often it's not the end, it's the start of the next phase. And I think that there is always that lovely moment. And I love the unboxing videos that everyone does now, you know, sort of hacking your fingers off with a pair of scissors to the finished book. And I think, you know, no matter how many times I write, and I hope this will always be the case, there's always that moment of, oh my goodness, like I made that happen from blank pages, and all those years and doubt, and it's not always pleasant. Sort of, you doubt yourself a lot, don't you? And you doubt the idea. And to see that book then, I think there's moments of summit, definitely, but it's about tenacity. It is about keeping the eye on the prize and keeping going even when it's hard. And that's where I misunderstood craft of writing when I first said, I've written a book.
Yeah, exactly. Back to the page. And of course, then you get to that point, you think, well, I'm never going to write another one again. And then you just find out that little fragment of history or something. You think, oh, that would make a good story. And then you're off again.
Yes, absolutely. Can't stop, can we?
Hazel, so grateful to you for taking time out of your day, because I know you're back and the kids are back at school. So this is a writing day for you. I've just got three very quick questions that I always pay off with. I ask all the interviewees, which is, what do you have a favourite childhood book? I know it'd be very difficult to narrow it down to one.
Oh, it really is hard to narrow it down to one. I'd have to go back to, I mean, I was raised on the Winnie the Pooh stories. And I think actually, as an adult, I can see the brilliance of character development.
Yeah, you didn't know it as a child reading it, but you do reading it back now.
Yeah, I mean, I was a very, very early reader, you know, went to the library every week. And I remember buying a box set of the Winnie the Pooh books. I still have it. It's probably on the shelves behind me somewhere. And I read it, I don't know how many million times. I just adored those stories. They're very, very precious to me, those characters. So I'd have to say,
Winnie the Pooh. Is it set on Wimbledon Common, or am I imagining that?
No, 100 Acre Wood. 100 Acre Woods,
Well, I've just realised, because I love those books as well, and I've just realised my grandfather told me that it was set on Wimbledon Common, and we used to go walking out over the common trying to find them. And I've now just realised that they weren't at all. That was just him capturing my imagination. God, it really worked.
That's brilliant. That's like when I used to take my kids when they were young, we used to go to the local forest and go looking for the Gruffalo. You know?
Oh, yeah,
the big kids' book at the time.
So what was your favourite library growing up, Hazel? Or it didn't have to be a library, it could be a bookshop.
Well, actually, libraries have been, that's why I was an early reader, because we had in I grew up in a little market town called Briffield in East Yorkshire, and it was the old boys' school from pre-war years, this lovely tiny little place. And my mum used to take me and my sister, and I have very fond memories of you could choose three books, and then you'd go up to the counter and you'd have a little label, which will see your library ticket, and the lady would stamp it, and you'd have, I think, 2 weeks to bring them back, or you'd get a fine.
Yeah.
And I can remember the smell of the place, I can remember the sound at the counter, I remember feeling I, you know, won the lottery walking out with these books. We didn't have enormous bookshelves at all at home. It was very much, you know, library, take them back, get some more. And I just adored books and reading from then. And so little Griffield Library is very, very fond memories for me.
Well, it's kind of what made you a writer, I suppose, isn't it? It shaped
I
your
think
writing,
so.
You know, because
Yeah.
readers become writers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my mom taking me to the library.
Yeah,
That's where the credit
same,
lies.
same.
Yeah.
I can still, as you're talking, I can still hear that thunk, you know, like at the
Yeah.
library stamp and
Yeah.
that kind of weird, slightly musty odor mixed with a bit of polish, mixed with an
Yeah.
undertone of something else. I don't know why.
Yeah. And the ticket was almost that sort of velvety kind of rough paper.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that had
The
been a bit
feel of it.
aged over time, but
Yeah.
they could slip it into that very satisfyingly,
Little
slip it into that
pocket.
little pocket. Yeah. Oh, I
Yeah.
love that.
Something so lovely about that. Yeah. So very, very much. And
Oh.
I've taken my kids to libraries, and I actually we're heading to New York in November, and I'm
Are
hoping
you?
to go to the New York Public Library, where they
Oh,
actually,
yeah.
to bring all those things together, they have the original stuffed toys from Winnie the Pooh. So Christopher
No,
Robin showed
do
the
they?
original Pooh, Eeyore, Tigger, and Piglet, I think, are at the New York Public Library
Oh,
in
I
New
did
York.
not know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah,
Well, you've got to make
yeah.
a beeline there then.
There you go. Yeah.
That's what I love about
Lots
these
of
podcasts, these little fascinating nuggets that you discover about. There's me thinking that Winnie the Pooh was always set on Wuthering
Yeah.
Common. You set me
Yeah.
straight.
So that'll be a full circle library Winnie the Pooh thing for me.
Yeah, I love the circularity of that.
Wonderful.
And if you were sent off to a desert island with only one book, what would that be? Like a
Oh,
classic that you think you could read and reread?
it's such a hard question.
I know. I need to really change
Hard
that actually, because it
question.
is such a hard question.
I mean, I don't, you see, I'd be torn between Great Expectations, Charles Dickens. I just think that story is amazing, and it's one of those, similarly with Jane Eyre, and I know that's always the answer, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, but it's almost like there's so many layers to those books, you forget when you go back to them that, oh, I thought you'd almost think that was a whole other book of
Yeah.
its own. You know, the years of Jane's life before she meets, it's just amazing.
Yeah. It's like
And
a
they read
writer's
so
Bible,
well.
that. How many people have said that? And about Charles
Yeah.
Dickens. But there must be reasons for those. I mean,
Yeah, they're just timeless, and I think you do almost feel that you're rereading the book every time. You know, I read Dickens' Christmas Carol every Christmas. You forget bits about it, and it's quite a short read, and it's quite dark in places.
and you read differently, don't you, as you get older, as you
Yes.
change, your perception, and I think personally, especially women's empathy grows stronger as they get older.
Yeah,
So we
definitely. You see
read,
things differently.
yeah, for
Yeah.
sure, and you read and you reread differently. So
Yeah.
that's a
And
really
as a
good answer.
writer, I mean, I think now as a writer, you always read with a bit of a critic's head on. And so you almost, I think when I reread classics now, I can see them. I can see technique and development. I can see things that author has done, which can sometimes interrupt the reading
Yeah,
process.
because you're thinking, I quite often, you know, and I love reading historical fiction, but I'm always thinking, oh, that's a good technique. Well, I like what they've done there. So you're being pulled out of the story, aren't you? But you
Yeah,
can't help that.
I might take a copy of The Girl Who Came Home as well, just to remind myself I did write books before I landed on an island, and I'd want to rewrite the whole thing now, probably.
And of course, with you as well, because you're on an island, you're terrified of the sea. You're never getting off there unless you build a lifeboat. And then that will be your survival
Well,
memoir at the end of it. So
I know how to survive. I know all the techniques, so maybe I'd be okay.
yeah, you face your worst fears finally. I feel like we've come full circle with that. We
We
started
have. That was
where we
really
ended
neat,
where we
Kate. Well
started
done.
off. Hazel, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
It's been brilliant to chat. Thanks a million.
I really hope that you enjoyed that conversation. If you have any questions or comments about any of the topics raised in our conversation, or perhaps you have a story you'd like to share, then do get in touch via my website, Facebook, or Instagram, details of which are all listed on the podcast. Thanks for listening.